Hello, and welcome to this week's installment of Nucleus Investment Insights. My name is Mark, and I'll be hosting today's webinar. Today, our topic is Trump broke the Shiller PE and how we can fix it. Today, our speakers are Shelley George, Operation Manager here at Nucleus Wealth. Good afternoon, Shelley.
Hey, Mark.
And as usual, we're joined by Damien Klassen, Head of Investments here at Nucleus Wealth. Good afternoon, Damien.
Hi, Mark.
Before we get started, a quick housekeeping message, a reminder to please do subscribe to our YouTube channel and click the bell to be notified when we are live or have a new webinar that you can watch. Or alternatively, you can follow us on your preferred podcast platform. For those listening in live, feel free to drop in your questions in the YouTube live stream chat and have them answered along the way. Now over to you, Shelley and Damien.
Thanks, Mark. Hey, I'm going to be asking questions of Damien today. But I thought the first one I wanted to start off was, what led you down the path of doing this work, Damien? Why did you go
yeah,
there?
Yeah, sure. So, look, as many sort of regular listeners will know, we've sort of been pulling back on our exposures to the market over the last month or so, and we're relatively conservatively positioned, you know, at the moment. And I guess a lot of this was coming back to the point about saying, well, you want to know when to buy back in, and you want to sort of make these like you don't want to sort of decide on the day. It's not sort of like a wake up this morning and feel like today's the day to buy and off you go or not. You know, it's more about saying, there's some fundamental reasons behind it. And when you look at sort of some of the various measures, the Shiller PE, which is one of the quite a widely followed one, particularly by value investors, is saying the market's got to fall sort of 50% before you'd actually talk about getting in. And so what we wanted to do was really challenge that and look at, what's wrong with that assessment and why there's reasons to be buying in much sooner than having to wait for a 50% fall before you want to buy.
Okay. So there's a number of questions I have off the back of that. One, you said at the moment you'd be looking for a 50% fall in the Shiller PE.
Sorry, I'm not looking for it.
But the Shiller PE is, okay. But some people in the market, commentators would say that's how much you're looking for. Yeah. Is that against long-term average valuations or what?
Yeah. So there's a maybe we could sort of start by bringing up some of the charts from the pack.
I've jumped ahead, have I? Because my other questions were, what's PE and what's the Shiller PE?
Yeah, sure. Well, so let's start with this idea of valuing. I mean, I'll even take one step back further and say, you know, what do we want to do in terms of valuation? And really, there's people use valuation in different ways. Sometimes, especially when you look at things like property and things like that, when people say valuation, what they really mean is what's the market price? They're just trying to say, well, you know, they're not actually trying to say where's this thing going to go. They're just trying to say, well, how much would people actually be prepared to pay for it? And because, you know, those assets don't trade very much, it's hard to tell. Whereas in when we're talking about the share market, we know what the price is. We get that reported that every day. So what we're really trying to work out is, where does the price sit versus what you actually get for it? And there's a bunch of different ways to measure it. Some ways use the balance sheet. So sometimes you look and say, well, how much assets does the company actually have? And you're trying to do a relative argument based on the balance sheet. Some are versus the cash flow, and they're the ones we tend to prefer to use. But some of the definitions get a bit weird.
Why do you prefer cash flows to assets?
Because you don't the cash flows are a lot harder to fake, and you know what's going on, and there's less ability to interpret the data. However, there is there's one or two big lines that are actually do require interpretation, which is you how much capital expenditure the company needs to make going forward. There's this really big assumption there, but other than that, it's very hard to fake. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the profits line, which is there's a lot of different areas where people that want to distort their earnings, so there's a lot of different places they can bury bodies it's harder to find.
And that's because profits based on accrual accounting, which has all of these rules around when you classify cash flows, right?
Yes, absolutely, and that's the other part. Part of the reason for doing this is that the good thing with the Shiller PE is he's done about 150 odd years back into the 1800s of data. which is great to have this long time series about what's been going on. But the issue is accounting standards haven't been constant over that whole entire period. So, you know, if we're looking at, say, climate change, and we're saying how much has temperature changed over this time frame, we know how we're measuring temperature, and there might have been, you know, there might not have been as accurate in the 1800s, but they weren't out by sort of, you know, 5 or 10 degrees. It's pretty close in terms of what we're looking at. We know temperature, you know, over that time frame. Whereas profits, the definition of what is a profit today is very different to the definition of what is a profit in 1900s or 1800s. And so it's a question about how much of these things changed, and then has there been any systematic distorting of the ratios? And
okay.
Yeah.
So we've got valuation, and we've got a definition of profits now. So how does that link into PEs?
Yeah, so then what we're basically doing is comparing the price that you're getting, the price you're paying for a stock versus what the earnings what earnings backs that up. And so what people will usually do, and what we do usually, is we look at forward numbers. So that tends to strip out a lot of the short-term movements, and it gives us a clearer look about where we're going. Having said that, analysts will have the tendency to, you know, things are always look better next year than what the actual reporting is, and they don't make adjustments for some of the more one-off. There's sort of one-off nature of things. It's always this view about what are the underlying earnings of a company, and if there's sort of one-off events that happen, often they'll strip out things like restructuring charges, or there's some get rid of the acquisition expenses. They might get rid of some big insurance payments that needed to be paid, or legal fees, which is, you know, as a forward looking sort of makes sense in a way, but some of those were real costs that the companies, and if that happens every 3 or 4 years, then by ignoring those costs, you're basically just overstating your earnings by doing that.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, so that's our P and our E. And am I right in saying these profits that we were talking about before are the same thing as earnings?
Yes, yes. Okay. I'm using them interchangeably.
So, okay, so we've got our PE. What about the Shiller PE now?
Yeah, so the Shiller PE, the difference they're doing there is saying, okay, well, markets go through cycles. They go up and they go down. And the issue is, if you look at the top of a cycle, what you'll find is that's when the earnings are the highest. And I'm talking about a cycle of earnings over a period, you know, going through recessions and not recessions. And so if you look at the period when earnings are the highest, the market's going to look the cheapest on that factor. So if I'm paying $1,000 for the market, and earnings are at $100, I'm saying, okay, I'm only paying 10 times the earnings. And so it looks quite cheap. And then earnings might fall to $50. And now, if it's $1,000 there, now I'm paying 20 times the earnings. So it looks expensive. And it's actually the opposite to what you'd want to be able to do. You want to do, because you want to sort of be able to say, well, when markets are really, when earnings are peaking, I don't want to be looking at the market and saying, hey, isn't the market really cheap? And when the market's fallen to the bottom, earnings have fallen to the bottom, I don't want to be looking at the market saying, hey, you know, earnings are really expensive, I shouldn't buy yet, because I'll be actually buying and selling at exactly the wrong times. So you want to sort of smooth it out and say, for that whole period, let me use $75 as the average. And then when the markets are, you know, now I'm comparing to the price, if the price is too high or too low, I can assess it based on that.
So it sounds like in both of those examples, or all of them, you're assuming the same price, P, because I guess in my mind I'm thinking about a cycle, and then you have high earnings and your price might move up with that as well. But it sounds like that's not what you're doing in this instance.
No, that's right. And that's a key to any of these valuations, is saying this. It's this issue of time frames. Not only are we talking about we can have earnings on different time frames, whether it's a 5-year average of earnings, or it's forward earnings, or it's backward earnings, and things like that. We've also got this issue about saying, I want to know right now, if I buy the market, is it cheap or expensive? And so I need to be using the current price at the moment and trying to work out what that's worth. Then I do want to know as well, you know, how has that changed over time? So I want to be able to say, you know, if I look back 10 years, I want to say, well, show me the price from 10 years ago versus the earnings that I would have been looking at, you know, 10 years ago, so that now when I'm comparing today, I'm saying, well, is this cheaper than what it was 10 years ago, or is it more expensive? But yeah, very important to be using the current price in all these assessments.
Okay. Yep. Great.
But one quick question, Damien. If you're using future earnings,
yep,
aren't those assumptions? I mean,
oh, absolutely.
How much weight can you put behind it? I mean,
look, you can. It's a factor in. You need to factor it all in. So for future stuff, look, I think it's probably one of the best ways at looking at what the underlying earnings are that the market is that will expect to come from this. So I think it's the best measure, but it's certainly not the only measure. And you do need to be looking at historical earnings. You need to be looking at averages. We do within our own, when we're looking at companies, we do purchasing power parity assumption things to look between different countries and different inflation rates and things like that. So you're right in that there's no one magic time frame that you should be looking at. And in particular, if I'm looking at a growth company like something like Google or Facebook or Apple, if I only ever look at historical earnings, you would never buy these things. And because next year the earnings keep getting higher and higher. On the flip side, there are stocks that are highly cyclical, and something the semiconductor stocks are very good examples of those. So if you look at those ones, they go through these big cycles of earnings. And if you tried to buy based on what the current price was versus the current earnings, or even forward, you'd lose money on that as a strategy, because they always look cheap when, you know, the price is that exactly those ones I was talking about, where they'll trade on 3 or 4 times earnings because everyone's looking at the earnings going, these earnings aren't going to last. And then they'll crash and they'll trade on like a negative PE. So because they'll have negative earnings. And then that's actually the time to be buying it, because that's when the earnings are lifting off. And and the other ones, resources companies are very similar as well. So, in recent months, you know, if you took the iron ore price at $240 or whatever it peaked out at, and compared to that to the current price, you got this incredibly low price to earnings ratios. But that was a signal that the market didn't believe the earnings. And so for those type of stocks, you do need to look backwards. And so it's really about a horses for courses, and there's no one magic formula that you can apply to every single stock and say this is what's going to determine the value of that stock.
Okay. Well, let's jump into this research you've done. But before that, can you give us like a one-line explanation of the Shiller PE?
Yeah, sure. So a 10-year average of earnings to, I don't know about one line, but I'll throw a short version.
Can I have two?
A 10-year average of earnings adjusted for inflation. Because the thing is, if a company earned $100 10 years ago and we've had 2% inflation, then that earnings is worth, you know, $122 today, without changing anything except that inflation. And so so you want to adjust for that, because you're trying to say you're trying to get a reasonable estimate of what the earnings might be.
Okay. So today's price divided by an inflation adjusted 10-year average of earnings. Damien?
Yes. Okay. I think this sort of shows that I've got a chart that then shows the difference there between those in the
adjusted and unadjusted for inflation. Okay.
Mm. So the problem though with the Shiller PE, and that's where I've got this next line, which is showing what the Shiller PE is that for the last 20 odd years, it's said the market has been incredibly expensive. So I've got this blue line there, and then a red line showing what the average up to that date is for the Shiller PE. And if you only bought when it was below average, you basically had, you know, in the last 20 odd years, you had one chance to buy and that was it. And, you know, or if you were only in the market, for example, if you only invested in shares when it was below that average, you were invested in shares for like 6 months out of the last 20 something years. So there's obviously something, there's either something wrong with that measure in terms of saying, okay, this isn't something we should be using, or it's a signal that accounting standards have changed. And I'm making the argument that it's actually mostly a signal that accounting standards have changed, but also that there's two quite simple changes we can make to this to actually give a much better feel for what's going on. So I'll start with the first one, which is the tax rates. So it sort of makes sense when you look at to say, okay, I'm taking this 10-year average of earnings, but then when you dig in a little bit deeper, you go, why we've sort of titled this that Trump broke the Shiller PE, is that the US had 35% corporate tax rates, and then they've fallen to 21%. And so when you do an average, you're averaging 6 years of 35% and 4 years of 21%. And you're actually sort of ending up saying, well, it's effectively what you're saying is I'm expecting a 29% tax rate for the next going forward. You're like, well, that's not the case. People are expecting a 21% tax rate, or you know, if you've got to factor in tax rises under Biden, you might have a different view. But you know, it makes a lot more sense to do an average of pre-tax profits and then just apply today's tax rate to it. So then what you find is after tax cuts, that makes the market look cheaper. But after tax rises, it makes it look more expensive.
So just thinking about this PE equation, if you run that through, so if you decrease the tax rate, then you're going to increase your earnings, right?
So this is the question about what one should you be doing. So if you said that, I guess what I'm saying is rather than I'm saying you should be looking at the pre-tax earnings instead. So if we look at the pre-tax earnings and then apply the average tax rate, that will increase our earnings, increase our after-tax earnings. Yeah.
Okay, I see. Yeah. So, yeah, that's what. Okay. So yeah, it increases earnings, and then in your PE, increasing the denominator is going to decrease the overall multiple, right? So that's where you come to this conclusion that it looks cheaper, or it is cheaper.
Yeah. Yes, that's right.
Right?
Yes.
Am I keeping up with you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, thanks. Right. So yeah, keep going. Sorry to interrupt.
Okay, that's step number one. Step number two is a bit more complicated, but it's another simple change that should be done is that it used to be prior to 1982, buybacks were illegal. So in the US, you weren't allowed to buy back stock. And buybacks have risen significantly over the last 20 years. And now they're as high as or higher than dividends. And so what I'm saying is what you should do is actually look at the dollar amount of profit that companies are making and then apply today's shares to that dollar amount of profit. And so, and the same part is we're trying to get a view about what's likely going forward. The fact that there was 10% of shares have been bought back in the last 3 years. When the Shiller PE does it does it on a per share basis. Whereas what I'm saying is we should be doing it on a dollar basis and then applying today's shares to it to get a better feel for it. And I've got some more complex examples for people interested in looking at it, but the one I've got on the screen is basically saying, well, if using this as an example, if I set up two index funds, so they're both buying the market, they both buy exactly the same amount of the market as each other, and then off they go, and one of them takes the dividends they get and pay it out to their shareholders, and the other fund takes the dividends that they get and they use it to buy back their own shares. So it's like they're both index funds. And I've just sort of worked through the maths just to show that if that was the case, the way I calculate it, under this scenario, they've got if they're paying everything out as a dividend, the PE you're paying for that stock is 19 times on a trailing basis. So if you actually look at just the price you're paying versus last year's earnings, if you do a Shiller PE, you get 19 times. And if you do my version, you get 19 times. So everything works out nicely. If you do it as a buyback though, all of a sudden my numbers and the latest numbers are still both 19 times, but all of a sudden the Shiller PE, the way it's calculated at the moment, jumps to 22 times just because of a technical way that it's not adjusting for these buybacks.
Because when a company buys back shares, is this right? they cancel them from the register. So if there was 300 shares, the company buys back 50, and then there's only 250 shares after they've bought them back.
Yeah.
So that means if their earnings stay the same and you had one share before and after, you got 1/300 of the earnings or 1/250 of the earnings, which is obviously a higher portion. And that's why you need to make this adjustment.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so, and you don't, the thing is, if this adjustment isn't necessary on a, if you're looking at forward earnings or if you're looking at the latest earnings and everything, because you're looking at a, you know, if I'm doing a price to earnings on 2020 earnings, I don't need to worry about it because I'm looking at the corporate structure that there is. And if I'm looking forward, I'm doing the same thing. It's the issue of looking over 10 years. I have to say, I'm looking at 10 years of a different corporate structure in each period. Okay. And I'm basically not giving shareholders the credit for having these buybacks that have come through. So
okay. And when you say looking over 10 years, you mean 10 years historically, because as you just said,
yes.
10 years into the future, you're going to make the assumption that the capital structure is going to stay the same because it's just easy to model that way.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah. So the net effect of those changes, just those two ones, which are, and I guess I'm breaking the changes that I've done into, I broke it into two articles because I think there's one set of changes, these ones that are like, well, there's not a lot of argument against this. There's no, you know, all we're doing is saying use the pre-tax dollars per share and then apply today's tax rate and apply today's numbers of shares. And I think there's a lot easier to understand. The other ones are more contentious, but just the effect of those changes, mean that the current PE sort of drops by almost 25%. So it sort of goes from being at record highs, you know, never been this high before, to actually it's high. It's not certainly not cheap, but it's 25% lower means it's 25% less that the market has to fall before you should be willing to step in and buy.
Yeah, right. That's huge.
Yes. Okay. So that's the simple changes. Now the complex ones, which are I'll try to simplify enough.
Let's
on
go.
That.
Let's see how we go. Let's,
yeah. The yeah, first one
I,
is.
I think I'll take this time to go get a coffee and come back in 20 minutes, maybe.
Then it's all. Yeah. Well, and then we'll have the answer.
All right.
So the next one is tax rates. So obviously in the first ones, I use statutory tax rates because that's what it's consistent over time. And we can see going back further. And part of the issue is that you've got international tax that US companies used to be mainly based in the US and used to pay most of their tax in the US. And over time, they've been paying more and more tax internationally. And international tax rates came down well before the US tax rates came down. So although, you know, the US statutory rate was 35%, US companies were paying under 30%. And that was partly because there are some sort of, you know, tax issues in terms of companies shifting their taxes to low jurisdictions and all these types of things. But there's also the issue that even if they were paying the statutory tax rate, if you had half your business in the US and the other half in Europe, then your average tax rate might have been 27%, and that was what you're paying, but it looks a lot lower than the US one. So there's that issue. But then there's the issue about saying, well, if we've taken this average of the actual, we've looked at the actual pre-tax profit that companies have made, then when we look at the rates for going forward, what rate should we be using going forward? Because in some of the years, and you can see this on the spike, you know, in the 2009 year, the tax rate spiked to over 50% because, and this was partly because of write-downs and other things, but investors didn't then think, oh, well, the actual tax rate paid was 50%. I need to go and change my model so the company's going to pay 50% tax rate forevermore. Like they were still, okay, well, you know, the statutory tax rate's 35, you know, you've got a blend, so, you know, you'll be paying less than that and factor that into the model. So, so it's a bit of a mishmash. So what I've done within mine is I've actually looked and said, okay, well, let's look at the average amount over the last 10 years, because prior to 2000s as well, companies actually used to pay higher than the statutory tax rate because of because of some accounting issues that weren't reflected, which I'll move on to later. But so it is a changing matter of what the expectation is. How much lower? What's this blend between US and international? And I've also, within my numbers, I then actually exclude some of these for the expectations part. I say, well, yes, it jumped to 50% for 1 year, but I'm not going to change expectations of investors. I'll leave investor expectations. So there's a little bit of arbitrariness within this.
And so do you have a view at the moment on whether there's likely to be a shift in tax rates going forwards? Because it's not something so much, I think, this year I've heard about, but, you know, for the last 5 years at least, there's been this ongoing international dialogue about what can we do to tax the large multinational conglomerates that are trying to set up tax havens or tax arbitrage and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, and in the meantime, tax rates have fallen. Trying to track them. Well, but also, I would like to hope that tax rates are going to get higher over time. I mean, I'm in terms of corporates, because I do think there's a certain portion of if companies are doing really well and people and consumers have to bear all the burden, then I think that sort of increases inequality and creates other political issues and economic issues. But having said that, they haven't been recently. Biden's spoken about putting some raising the corporate tax rate, and it's quite possible that he will get some sort of corporate tax rate rise. The flip side is there's not many other countries out there looking at it at all. Okay. You know, Australia's still on the we need to cut the tax rates for corporates. I think there's and the other factor on that was they've put in some rules about trying to have a global minimum tax that will hopefully stop the race to the bottom. But will that then turn into will that actually start lifting it or not? And so I think we're still a while away from consensus on starting to lift corporate taxes. So the net effect is I'm certainly not factoring tax rises. Outside of the US, okay. I'm not factoring tax rises into modeling and things like that. The next one's accounting standards. So the issue, I guess it's a great contrast about how things have changed is looking at a pandemic from 1919 versus 2020. So if you're a company running into your 1919 pandemic and all of a sudden your earnings halved and you looked at the value of your assets and you said, okay, we've got these factories and they're only running at half capacity and, I think it's worth $100 million, I bought it for $100 million, but, all these problems, I have to write it down by half. So you write down your property. 2020, same thing happens. You assess it. You've got the rules are a bit stricter in terms of what you have to do and the checks to make sure you do write down those assets. So 2020, you're more likely to write it down, but that first effect is pretty similar. Now you come out of the pandemic and you actually go, well, we come roaring out and actually, profits rebounded really quickly and we're back to normal. In 1919, you then went and wrote the value back up to your $100 million. So yes, you had this one-off fall of $50 million in the first year and then right back up and then you're off and running. In 2020, it is very, very hard to write up an asset.
Why is that the case?
They changed because companies would...
inflate it.
Yeah, companies use that extra ability to value their assets to overstate the value of their assets. So the idea is a lot around conservatism within the accounting standard and making sure that, But the net effect is if I looked at earnings from 1919 and the effect around the pandemic compared to 2020, I'm going to get a different answer, even if the earnings were exactly the same for the two companies. So we do need to adjust for that. The other thing is then, and I've got an example of a company here up on the screen. So we've got this company earning $100 a year, and then it buys this asset for $50, and that asset's going to earn $5 a year. And so now I'm earning $105, and I'm going forward. This new division I've bought runs into trouble and blows up some money, and the earnings fall to negative. So now the asset, and we look at that asset and we go, you know what, we bought it for $50. It's not worth anything. We're going to write it off completely. So for 1 year, our earnings are our original $100 and then the $1 that we're losing from this new asset, and then write off the $50. So for 1 year, we earn $49. And then after that, we're going to earn $99 going forward. So that's our company model. The way the Schiller PE looks at this is it says, okay, I'm going to take your, you know, a couple of years of $100, and then I'm going to take this 1 year of $105, and then I'm going to do 1 year of $49, and then $99, you know, after that. Whereas the way investors look at this is they only care about the $99, because they look at it and say, okay, yes, you might have bought an asset for $50, but the reality is we don't care whether you bought it for $50 or $500 or $1, or you got it for free. All that matters is how much is this asset going to earn you going forward, and what's your new capital structure? So
can I just clarify something there? When you say as an investor looking at it, you don't care how much you bought it for, is that when you're looking at the stock and thinking, am I going to buy it or sell it? Because obviously, yes, if you owned the company before they made that purchase, you might care.
Yes, you care, but to the extent that the penalty you pay for making that a bad investment is that you will now have a different capital structure. You will now either have more shares because you had to issue shares to buy this thing, or you'll have more debt. But once you've done that, and you're sitting at this point looking forward.
Yeah. Okay.
What matters is the $99 and your current capital structure. And so if you then go back and penalize the company as well by saying, okay, I'm going to look at you at $99 in your current capital structure, but I'm also going to penalize you another $49, then it's a way of double counting.
Okay.
So that's one issue. But the problem then comes onto this next page is that companies then work that out pretty quickly. And so they say, okay, write-downs are going to be, if you're going to write, you know, if investors are going to ignore write-downs, then we need to make fake write-downs that, you know, we'll just call everything a write-down we can. And so you see some companies come out and they call, the one I love is inventory write-downs, where they say, oh no, we've just written down our inventory. And you say, and it sounds similar, but it's not. Like an inventory write-down just basically means, look, I spent $100 making these widgets and I could only sell them for $50. And so I'm going to write the value down by $50. And you're like, just a minute, that's just making a loss. That's not a, you know, it's just a fancy way of saying I made it for more than what I sold.
And it could happen in the future, right, again.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's not the thing of I bought an asset and then that asset is not worth what I paid for it, so I'm writing it down and I don't want to double count. An inventory write-down is just a genuine, I just lost money and I'm just giving you a fancy name that you might confuse into ignoring it, you know. And then there's and restructuring charges pop into the same bit. They're always talking about restructuring charges companies and encouraging people to look at their numbers without the restructuring charges. But they have a restructuring every 2 or 3 years or every, some companies just have it every year.
Every year, yeah.
Yeah. And as well, when they have a restructuring charge, they'll throw everything into it that they can. They'll be like, you know, here's a manager who looked sideways at that company once, that division once, right? Okay, we'll write 60% of your salary off, you know, just regardless, you know, they'll throw everything they can into the more disreputable companies. So when you do want to look at these accounting changes, you want to be able to say, okay, well, we want to strip out the effect of these that increased write-downs are having on the earnings over the last 20 years, because that's the only period in which we've had these new accounting standards. But we also want to acknowledge that companies do all these fake write-downs, so we need to try and get the right ones. And then the sources of data aren't very good on these. It's, you know, no one does it well because the companies are trying to hide what's going on. And so, yeah, it's quite hard to get to the bottom of it. Then you've got goodwill amortization, which was something from 20 years ago that's actually, that used to understate earnings. And so that's sort of working the opposite direction. So you sort of got to cancel those two out. You know, I'm not an expert in US accounting standards in the 1950s or 40s or whatever it is. And so I need to acknowledge as well that maybe there was stuff going on in those periods that everyone knew at the time and stripped it out, but I just don't know about. But anyway, the net effect of doing all this stuff is that your PE is looking less extreme around some of your crises when we adjust for those.
So that's just the profs?
It actually affects your peaks of your PEs, because what you're doing is your earnings, your bottom doesn't fall as far, and so you get that. So that's my change number two. Complex change number three is that profits are overstated almost at all times, and particularly if you've got large amounts of capital, because what happens is we've got this thing called historical cost accounting. So I buy a factory for $100 million today, and it's going to last me 20 years, and so I'm going to depreciate that factory at $5 million a year for the next 20 years. In 10 years' time, the cost of building that factory, if I wanted to replace it, might not be $100 million. It might now be $200 million, or even just with inflation, it's going to be, it will have increased by 20% just because of inflation. And so every year I'm depreciating $5 million, but if I'm looking at it as the cost of replacing it would actually be more like a $7 million a year change. So there's always this sort of bit of understating. Now, if inflation was constant over the entire time period, then that wouldn't matter, because we're just saying, oh, it doesn't matter because, it's in some periods we're comparing the same amounts and other ones we're not. We're always understating by the same amount. So if we're looking at this over a long period, who cares?
So do you mean inflation is constant, like at 2% every year, or inflation is zero?
Oh, sorry. If inflation was constantly 2%, then we'd always be understating by the same amount.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I see. Guess.
So therefore the ratio doesn't really matter. We'll just...
Because you're comparing. Yeah.
But the issue is inflation hasn't been constant. And if you, particularly in times of high inflation, that factory I built for... So if we've got 10% per annum inflation, the factory I built for 100 million, 10 years later might be 200 million or 300 million to build. And so... And the reality is companies knew about this. In the 70s, there was actually an accounting standard that required companies... That required companies to give both the historical cost and the replacement cost, because inflation was so high, everyone knew it was an issue, and so they required companies to report on it. And so there was a Harvard survey that was out in 1977 that sort of picked the top 100 US companies, and that's the one I've shown up on screen, and it's showing that if you used historical cost, you got $30 of earnings, $30 per share. And if you used replacement cost, you got $20 per share. So it was basically a 50% increase. Your profit was overstated by 50%. It's a big amount. Like those depreciation charges are massive in the scale of things. So what that means is what we need to do is look over time and, adjust the earnings for... I adjust everything back to a 2% inflation rate, but adjusting for that overstatement. And you find that right throughout the 70s, this Shiller PE and all other PEs as well were like 7 times or 5 times earnings. Like it seemed like it was really, really cheap. But a lot of the reason was that people looked at the earnings and went, we know those earnings are wrong. And so I'm not going to pay 20 times earnings for earnings that I know are overstated. I'll pay a lower amount. And so that's
inflation was high, and that's kind of the opposite of what we have now, right?
Coming back
to this idea of overflated or overpriced equities.
Yeah, it doesn't make that much difference at the moment. We've had I've basically said, look, between 1% and 3%, that's roughly where we've been most of the time. And so that's fine. What we really need to worry about is periods where we've had deflation, a considerable period of deflation or considerable period of inflation running at 5 or 10%. Like those, that makes a big difference. Whether you're running at 2.5% or 1.5%, doesn't make that much difference to the overall. Yeah. So that's the next change. Then we go in and say, okay, well, trading costs are not the same. So it used to cost you, if you wanted to buy stocks, I've got two charts up here, one showing the average trading cost, and this is just a one way. So if you wanted to do a buy and a sell, you're paying almost 2% in terms of your trading costs, sort of back pre-1960, say. And then the other thing is the bid and ask spread. So the difference between that you'd have to pay to get into a stock was also, could be up to 0.5%. So you sort of look at all that and you say, well, if we're looking at exactly the same assets today, and I know I can buy them and get a 1% better return just because my trading costs are lower, then I should be prepared to pay more for those assets. And so,
because your effective price is therefore then going to be the same.
Yeah, my effective return as an investor is the same. So I invested $100, I got back $150 today, or 100 years ago, I invested $100 and I'd have to pay a lot less because I have to count for the fact that I'm going to be charged, 2% in fees before I even get started, and then if I do need to trade. And then the other part is diversification, which is a lot easier today than what it used to be. So, anyone can go out and buy the S&P 500 and get a full suite of all stocks, whereas 100 years ago, to get diversified, you had to go out and buy all these things individually and track them and do all that.
Oh, so ETFs, that's just one transaction instead of 500.
Exactly. So, so the ease of getting diversification is much easier now than what it used to be. And so, does that mean that there should be some sort of extra premium you pay for cheaper diversification, I suppose, is where I'm coming to. And so, it gets quite complex. And then they get parts about, well, they used to trade a lot less then, and, how much does it cost per year? And, there's all these different factors going on. And why you say, they used to trade a lot less in most of the periods, but then you get periods like the 1920s where they didn't. They actually traded more than what. And so, there's a lot of sort of rules of thumb and guesses and adjustments, but so I also make an adjustment for this. I charge about, I sort of go, I think the costs were probably about 1 to 1 a bit percent more back in the earliest century, and then gradually falling back. It sort of was pretty constant for a long time, or only fell quite gradually, and then sort of post the 1970s really dropped
computers
away.
Computers started to.
Yeah, and there's some rules around some regulatory changes as well that came through that helped drop the fees. But yeah, computers in the 2000s. So the big changes for the 70s and 80s was regulatory, and then post that was computerization.
Okay.
I'm going to skip the next one, negative earnings. So this is one which I don't actually make an adjustment for, but there's some arguments with negative earnings, whether you want to see companies with and without. I'll leave that for people to read. That's probably a bit more complicated. And the other one which Shiller himself makes an adjustment for, and some other people make an adjustment for, is reinvestment. Oh, he does two versions, one with reinvestment, one without. I don't, this is one I don't agree with. So I don't make any changes for this. So basically the argument some people make is, if companies are paying lower amounts of dividends today than what they used to, that means they're retaining more capital, and therefore they should grow faster than the companies that that aren't. And so, in a broad sense, I say yes, that's true. I agree with that as an overall statement. But you also need to look at other things that are going on, though.
Can I just jump in there and ask where the direction of causality in that statement is? Are they retaining the capital because they have higher growth opportunities, or are they higher growing because they're retaining the capital?
Oh, yeah. It's a very important question, and who knows what the answer is.
All right.
And I think different companies, the answer is different for different companies.
Okay, right. Yeah.
Some will be doing it because, in the end, some are retaining the capital because they're like, okay, we want to make a big acquisition. And so we're just sort of building up a bit of a war chest, and then we'll go out and buy something. And then other ones might be, actually, we've got too much debt at the moment. We actually want to pay our debt down a bit. And so, so there's lots of different things. But I've got three different examples here of companies, though. So if I've got three companies, all are making $100, and they all want to invest $75 in the next year. So the easiest way is company A says, okay, I'll pay a $25 dividend, and I'll keep the other $75, and I'll go and spend that on investment the next year. And then you have a second company that says, okay, I'm going to pay a $50 dividend. I'm going to buy back $50 of my shares. And then I'm just going to go and borrow $75 when I want to make that investment. And then the last one says, well, I'm actually going to pay out $100 of dividend. And then I'm going to go raise some new shares to go and do this new investment. And I guess what I'm saying is all three of those companies have done the same thing. And if you're doing the Shiller adjustment, basically adjust for the first company, but not for the others. And so I'm saying, well, if you're going to do it, you've got to be consistent. And if it, if you're going to change for one set of capital, you need to change for all sets of capital. And so, yeah. So anyway, so I've got, and I do, yeah. So there's parts in that where I've, I go into a bit more detail in the
article,
but yeah, but basically the idea is that's one change I don't think you need to make for. So what does that do? So forgetting all the nuances of how I've got there. So what it really does is, in historical years, it lifts the PE, the effective price to earnings, on a similar basis to what we are now. So you can see that the blue line on this chart is where the official sort of CAPE, the Shiller version, is, and the red line is my version. So after making all those changes, it actually doesn't change the current position very much. But what it does is it lifts all these historical ones. And you can see, particularly in those periods of high inflation, you go from, you know, less than 10 times PE gets lifted to closer to 15 times. And right back through time, you sort of get a bit of a lift, and, you know, taxes and things like that vary from year to year. But the net effect is, really, over the last 20 years, it turns the last 20 years from saying, oh, if you're going to buy it below average, you had one chance to buy. Instead, now, when you look at the last 20 years, you go, well, it's just a typical period. Yes, you had some extremes at one end and some extremes at the other, but the net effect is there was opportunities to both buy and sell throughout that period. And it also says that if you're sitting looking at this saying, when do I buy, you're not looking at it saying, okay, it's almost 40 times earnings and the average is 17 or 18. I need the market to fall by 55% before I want to buy. You're now looking at it saying, okay, well, it's almost 30 times, but if it fell by, it has to fall a lot less before you actually say, it's reasonable value.
Do your adjustments lift the average as well?
Yes, in earlier years. No, in later years. So I've got the next chart. I've actually got the average line over a period. So,
okay.
Yeah. So the average to date is higher in earlier years, lower in later years than the original Shiller PE. But you can see it's sort of roughly 20 times is where it is. And then the last chart I wanted to show as well is, this is what Shiller's been taking this one out sort of as an explanation as to why his model hasn't been hasn't given you as many buy signals recently. And so, this is a valid way to look at it. This is important to do. What he's doing is comparing it to bonds and looking at the excess cyclical PE. And so, and when you look at this, when you look at it, his measure this way, it comes out and says, okay, it's still expensive, still a little bit more expensive than it has been, but it's nowhere near as expensive. If I do it through my measure, it actually says, look, it actually looks a little bit cheap. The market looks a little bit cheap relative to bonds at the moment, which is a sort of two-edged. I don't think the market's actually cheap. It's what it's saying is, look, bonds are really expensive as well. And bonds, on a relative basis between stocks and bonds, stocks have a slight edge in terms of bonds are really, really expensive, and stocks are just really expensive. So, so there's an element of that, but it does mean if you're picking the choice between if you're trying to do your asset allocation as to, when I want to buy bonds and when I want to buy equities, it does tilt you, a little bit more towards equities than using the Shiller one from scratch. So hopefully that's not, it's obviously, quite complicated and in the weeds, but I think it's sort of, to me, it's instructive to whenever you look at any ratio over time, you need to be saying, well, what's changed over, especially definitional issues and not just sort of taking things at face value as to the numbers that sort of roll straight out.
So you talked about briefly what this means for your positioning in the investment models at Nucleus Wealth. Do you want to just go over that again? Maybe, I don't know if you want to add some more detail.
Yeah, sure. So, what it really means, so we've been Yes, we've spent the last couple of months sort of winding back on our equity exposures with the view that, look, there is a growth. We've spoken about sort of the growth scare we think is coming. And for us, then it's about saying, and I'd encourage anyone who's looking at the market in a similar way, is you should be identifying now, before the market has really fallen much, what are your levels at where you're prepared to start buying back in again? And because what will happen is when the market does fall, the papers and all the press and investment things are all going to be about how terrible things are and how it's, you know, they'll overstate things on the upside, and then they'll overstate things on the downside. And so you always want to try and predetermine, you know, what are the constraints that are actually going to get you into or out of the market. So, and this is just one of, you know, a bunch of different measures you should be looking at, but it is an important measure and one that's quite widely looked at.
And when you say growth scare, what are you referring to?
So, yeah, our expectations are that there's twofold. In the US is less of an issue, but that's basically, there's a handoff between, they sent out a lot of checks to consumers last year and early this year, and they've got these big infrastructure projects that are coming next year and the year after. But there is a bit of a gap in between, and so you could see a bit of a growth slowdown in the US. And we've also seen this inventory super cycle that we think is coming off. And so we think there's partly that. More importantly, though, is China genuinely looks like it's trying to rebalance its economy. And it's trying to do some good things there, but there is some genuine slowing. And we saw, you know, just yesterday, there was a bunch more stats came out just showing that what's happening in the housing market is there, which is really the engine for growth in that market, and really where the most of the excesses are and most of the debt's going, is there's some real genuine slowdowns going on. And it doesn't look like they're going to reverse. You know, I think there's in the short term, I think eventually things will get so bad they probably will reverse, but the more that comes out of it, you see about the measures that Xi Jinping is taking, the more it looks as if they're genuinely trying to slow that market down and to rebalance to a more sustainable economy, which is going to cause some short-term pain.
Right.
I mean, if I could step in here a second, some of the articles I've read, the construction companies are really, I mean, teetering on collapse.
Evergrande confirmed today they're going to default on some payments. Wow. So there are a bunch of different it's a long story. We've got a few podcasts out, and actually we'll probably be doing one not next week or the week after on this in more detail. Yeah. But that market's genuinely slowing down and not looking like reversing at the moment.
I mean, that seems like a severe pain coming for our resource companies over here. But
absolutely, and it's already happening. We've already seen the iron ore price, you know, halve effectively. And you could see it halve again without, you know, wouldn't be a surprise to us to see at least a similar type of fall. But don't sleep on the fact that the Chinese housing market as well is not just steel and iron ore. There's also all these other metals that go into it. There's the whole suite of nickel and
copper
and those, yeah, nickel, copper, aluminium, you know, all these other factors that the Chinese housing market is a huge source of demand, and they'll all be affected by the same factor. Mm-hmm.
Not looking great for Australia with a few capital cities under lockdown and heading into that. I don't know.
No, that's right. And so,
where Lowe got his glass half full from earlier this week.
In terms of how we're positioning a portfolio as well, is we're very underweight Australia in terms of the equities portfolio. So we're underweight equities overall, but Australian equities we're extremely underweight with that view. Is that, yeah, it is, things look more attractive offshore. Australia certainly had a better coronavirus overall experience in a lot of countries, but now we're about to hit the bad part of it, where we will open up and we will get the shock to hospital systems and things like that. The ones that other countries have been dealing with for 18 months now, and plus on top of that, we're facing, you know, our largest trading partner really trying to get away from using using commodities as much as they can.
Well,
oh dear. One more question for me before we finish. So the stuff we've that's not my job to call it, but so everything we talked about in this episode, Damien, you've actually come from a couple of articles that you've published. On where can people read more about it?
Yeah, so it's on our website. It's got republished on places, Bloomberg, one of the Wall Street Journal offshoots did a piece on it as well. A bunch of different other places picked up on in some of their charting. A bit different newsletters sort of wrote about it. So yeah, so it's actually it's been one that we've actually had a lot of international interest in terms of other researchers and companies sort of approaching us and talking about the issues. So I think there's a whole range of different places, but the Nucleus Wealth website is probably the first place to start. But lots of other places you can see it as well.
Great. So we'll put the links to that in the description, I think.
Yeah, that might be a good starting point for some people to look at, yeah.
Sounds good.
Mm-hmm. All right. So I guess it comes down to what's the question of the week? I mean, does valuation even matter anymore? Where we've just had this long discussion about how it can be manipulated and how you're trying to find the truth within the numbers over here. But do give us your feedback. I mean, what do you think, whether the evaluation really matters anymore? And I think we'll start winding it up there. Thank you, Shelley and Damien. I mean, I, for one, can definitely say it makes more sense to me. And I hope that our viewers have found informative as well. Thanks again to all of you who have watched this episode live and those of you who have asked questions. We do welcome your feedback on this show and any suggestions for topics you think we should cover. Don't forget to click like on the video right now. And finally, if you know somebody who might get something out of today's episodes, please share it with them. And anything else? All right. If you'd like to see more of our previous webinars, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content. To stay up to date with us, you can also follow us on social media. Thanks again for tuning in for myself, Mark, and the rest of the team here at Nucleus Wealth. And we look forward to seeing you at the next one.
Thanks, guys.
It was such a shock hearing you in my ear, Jay.
I know, it freaks.
Well, sorry.
I know. The first time he did that, I was like, what? Because I was responding to him. I didn't realize that there's a voice in my head. Well done, guys. I think I actually understood it for the first time. Shelley, you should be a teacher.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe. Yeah, why not? Go get that PhD and start teaching.
There was a few times that I was like, oh, I've lost him. Hang on, let me think. Okay, yeah, I'm back.